Welcome to the Off the Road Again podcast. I'm Chris.
I'm Ross.
I'm Todd.
This is our podcast about anything and everything off-road. I'm giggling because I messed up the intro again. For the longtime listeners, you'll know I don't normally do that, but I've done it back-to-back shows now. Or not back-to-back shows. There's a couple of gap between them.
It depends on the shows come out.
Well, I decide when they come out, so I'll make sure it's not back-to-back.
You are the master of scheduling.
As always, it's socially distanced. We don't know how to do the show and be in the same place. So like if we actually have an episode where Ross and I are in the same space, it'll be the weirdest episode we've ever had.
Are we going to like sit on opposite sides of the room with our laptops and our own mics?
Yeah. Like, I'm going to be in a separate room. I'm not going to be room.
Just back. Gonna,
yeah.
We haven't crossed this bridge yet.
Hear it through the walls. Yeah. So I'm still in the Midwest. I'm in Kansas City. If you really want to get specific, I'm on the Kansas side. For those of you that don't understand, that's in two different cities. Not even in Kansas City, Kansas. Anyway, Ross is in the Northeast in Connecticut, and Todd's in Jersey.
Also in the Northeast.
Yes.
And I just had a four-year-old sneak up on me and cough.
Four-year-old's like, I don't know what time zones are. So, Todd, it is rare that we have two people in the same time zone, let alone within a quick drive or relatively quick drive of each other. So,
well, I'm glad I can make it at least a little bit easier.
Yeah. Scheduling is a lot simpler when all three of us have time zones that butt up on each other versus, you know, sometimes it's like two or three in the US and somebody in Australia, which always makes, it's like, oh, I'm having my breakfast coffee.
He's a day ahead minus 7 hours. I got Joel. I know his time zone now.
There you go.
There wasn't a lot of news, but the news we're going to talk about is that Backcountry Discovery has released another route. Yes. It's kind of big.
They've been teasing it for a few months now. I think it's been in the works for a couple of years because it's, you know, there's a lot of planning that goes into these. But in case you're not familiar with them, the Backcountry Discovery routes, BDRs, are methods, they're routes and preset plans by which you can basically travel across the entire state almost exclusively or exclusively off tarmac, depending on which route, which state it is. So newest one's been released. It's Wyoming and it's enormous.
And it's loading.
It's loading. Chris's screen is like, wow, I got to think about all these places to go. It's the biggest backcountry discovery route yet. These are becoming increasingly popular for overlanders and dirt bikers. And I actually do think there is a New Jersey BDR. Let me check on that.
Ooh, I know there's new, like they call it like Northeast.
Yeah, it goes from South Jersey. Let me see if I get this right before I actually pull up the picture. But it goes from South Jersey kind of to like New Hampshire, and there's only a few sections of pavement that you actually have to do. Yeah, Northeast. So
we do have more than the Turnpike.
Over the Garden State, yeah.
I've driven that Turnpike.
Well, I was totally wrong. So it actually starts in the very northeastern tip of Pennsylvania, goes across New York into, believe it or not, the north tip of Connecticut through Massachusetts, up into Vermont, and then across New Hampshire into Maine and back into New Hampshire. So I retract what I said about New Jersey. Even though I do think
Turnpike it is.
Yeah,
Turnpike
right.
It is.
Hey, I mean, you know better than I do. Some parts of the Turnpike might as well be off-road, but I do think there is a way to get across New Jersey mostly on dirt.
For whatever reason, the scroll is very sensitive.
Yes, it is particularly sensitive. So some of those places that crosses on that map, I've actually off-roaded before. So
anyway, the Wyoming one, it looks amazing. But you can now connect New Mexico to Colorado to Wyoming for an epic trip. If you so choose.
Yeah, if you have the time.
Yes, I have a friend who has ducked down into New Mexico for a little bit. I did not hover over that, but
surprise.
So yeah, they ducked down into New Mexico for a little bit, and then they ran most of Colorado. But yeah, so Wyoming, Northeast, California, they have sections of California. I don't think they've done every section of California yet, but but then Nevada, Utah, Idaho, Colorado, Washington, New Mexico, and Arizona.
Yep.
So I'm very excited, especially because like some of the pictures were like, I feel like the suburban can do this kind of thing. Like the suburban is very
right,
not prepped for this yet, but.
So keep in mind, these BDRs are really geared towards the, like, not entry-level enthusiasts, because you really do have to be hardcore to do one of these entire things, but they're not meant for extreme vehicle usage. You know, they're not rock crawling. It's not deep mud. It's really for the person who wants to go sightseeing instead of, like, hardcore off-roading, which is good because it gets more people into the hobby and, you know, some of the scenery, it looks absolutely spectacular. And for the record, the New Jersey one is called the Trans New Jersey Trail. It is 450 miles of dirt roads spanning the state of New Jersey.
That makes me, I didn't know New Jersey was that wide or tall.
North, south.
Yeah, but like Kansas is like four something east to west. Like,
I mean, it takes quite a while to go north, south in Jersey. Now, especially if you're stuck in Sunday night beach traffic.
Right. Well, and I was like, as I say, it's east to west, like that's the interstate. Like I'm not traversing dirt roads left and right. Like I'm sure. So that's probably how we get to 450 miles of New Jersey there. But anyway, yeah. I'm excited about all of the backcountry discovery routes that I haven't done yet.
Yep. That we will hopefully someday do.
Yes. Let's talk about your project is no longer.
Yes, it is. Well, it
chop
is.
Chop.
No, it's not Chop Shop. Let's be clear. It was at the Custom Shop in Astoria in Queens. And it is not a Chop Shop. It is a very, very, very good facility and they do excellent work. So the Lexus, everything that was to be done on the Lexus is done. And this is a picture of what it looks like now. Again, thank you to all of the parties that have been involved in this. Custom Shop, Ironman 4x4, Toyo, Wheel Pros and Botegi. Who am I forgetting?
Midland,
Warren, they've all been amazing. They and I are both very excited for this project. And now it's time to hit some dirt. So Monday, going off-road Monday.
Todd, I told him I needed to test the Suburban off-road and he's like, come Monday. And I was like, I'm not going to make it. That's a stretch. Like
start driving now. But yeah, it came together great. It drives, you know, I have like extensive conversations with Ironman about this specific suspension, the Foam Cell Pro kit, and how it will act on road. And it drives like 99% like a stock vehicle, which is like compared to the, you know, lifted trucks that I've had experiences with in the past is so refreshing. Now I just have to deal with a few other things that have devolved. So the spare tire no longer fits in the spare tire location. And it's like 95 pounds worth of tire to throw up into the trunk every time I, you know, need it. And now I just got to figure out what to do. So with developments to come.
With your giant spare tire.
Dude, it's not even that big. It's a 285/70/17. You know, it's a 32.8 inch tire. It's not like it's a 35 or a 37 or something, but.
Silly question. And I know you sent me the image today and I don't have this in my brain. Mm-hmm. Is it the same rim on the spare that you have on the other four? Okay.
Same wheel, same tire. It's an identical fifth matching spare.
Sweet.
And yeah.
Ooh, I see it now.
Projects never end. Suffer the embarrassment of the steel non-matching spare tire.
No, I've been there. You know, the fifth matching one I've found to be just especially reassuring in off-road situations when you're deep in the woods, just because, you know, in a two-wheel drive vehicle or or something with a selectable transfer case, you can always just throw one of the tires that are bad in the front and then just leave it in two-wheel drive and find your way out in two-wheel drive, not worry about transfer case or differentials or anything. But the Lexus is full-time four-wheel drive, so don't really want to screw with that in any way.
So you kind of have a solution.
It's a temporary solution. It's not perfect.
Where's your back seat?
Folded.
That's where the spare tire used to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right. So I tried standing it up, but the door just won't close.
Yeah.
Even deflated. So, you know, everything's a project and no project is ever really over.
I love that I'm giving a hard time about that, but even to get any wheeler tire in the back of the Suburban, I still have to lower the third row seat. Like, it's there's a lot of room in the back of a Suburban, but not quite enough.
I've never actually put the third row in the Lexus into its upright position. I might actually just take it out. Like, then I get another 6 or 7 inches of depth for cargo.
I understand, like, you'd get more depth of front, but like that third row doesn't go all the way to the back. So like it would be a weird step down thing. You'd have to almost like make
but it's still space.
Platform.
Yeah. Meh.
Doors.
That's my news. And the other news is actually extremely timely. The Ram TRX left yesterday and was replaced by a 2022 WRX. The new WRX is here, and I have it for a week, going to spend some time with it. I haven't driven a WRX since I owned my 2017. So it's very, very full circle. And there's a review coming for Everyday Driver, which will go live on March 12th to coincide with the first article I ever wrote for Everyday Driver going live 4 years ago about my own WRX. So very holistic.
It's not orange.
It's very, very red. Like, I thought the Ram was red. This is like 5 miles per hour over, and I'm getting pulled over red.
So. Also, is there a bigger juxtaposition, like TRX to WRX size? Like, it's
in terms of size.
Yeah. Like, you went from this truck that is, you couldn't, it was taller than your garage by feet.
Yep.
And now this will fit in perfect.
It will. Yeah. Well, it's currently like half parked on my grass because I have one in 2/3 cars worth of driveway, and you know, I didn't want to park a press car on the street. So yeah,
I will vouch for him that the red is very bright. It's really bright.
Yep. See, so my initial impressions, and I just want to get this out there because I've driven it maybe 10 miles and that's not really grounds for a fair evaluation yet, but everybody went crazy about the cladding, about the fender flares, and about the front bumper, you know, and side skirts, and then the big addition of dark plastic to the rear bumper. In person, like, it looks fine. It's not, you know, everybody who spoke about it or saw it online or like at an auto show said it was the worst thing ever, and it looks totally fine. Like, it looks like it's durable instead of just getting, you know, paint that'll be beaten up. So
also internet culture. If you're not offended, what are you supposed to be?
Right. That's absolutely correct. So yeah, very, very much looking forward to putting some miles on it this weekend.
Sweet. I jumped away from mine. I bought things.
You did.
I did. I think did I talk about it on the last show?
You talked about the leveling kit.
Okay. So leveling kit arrived in the mail. And then it decided to snow. We got somewhere between 6 and 10 today, but because it drifted, it's like 4 and 14.
Nice.
So it's going to be a hot minute till I get the leveling kit on it.
How are your tires today?
Oh,
let's do a shameless plug.
it's starting to become a shameless plug because we've talked about them quite a bit, but like it's gotten to the point where I have Redestein Pinza all terrains on it, or ATs. Yeah. They are not an aggressive tire in any way, shape at all. Like, they look more, if you just walked up, you'd be like, oh, you have all seasons on it, but
they're reminiscent of like a Pirelli Scorpion ATR or something like that.
They have been so kick ass in the snow. It is, I mean, it probably helps that I'm running 5,800 pound Suburban on top of them. To make sure, but like today, like I had a doctor's appointment this morning at like 8, and they were like, oh, there'll be no snow on the ground. You'll be totally fine. And when I started out, I was like, there's a lot of snow on the ground already. Like there, I was, I will say that goddamn front air dam on the front of the truck.
Again, watching still,
I was watching snow go blasting out in front of the truck because the air dam was pushing. I was my own snowplow.
The leveling kit will help.
Yeah. The leveling kit will raise it up 2.5 inches. And so we'll be good. But, the tires are great. I made it to my doctor's appointment super easy. I made it home. Then at lunchtime, when it was kind of nuts with like 6 to 8 inches of snow, I was like, hey, you know what? I'm gonna go get a sandwich. And so I went out. I'd been stuck at home with the kids all morning. Like, I didn't want to be there.
Only person on the road kind of day.
No, that's
really, I guess it's snow country.
We're snow country, but we're not. And we also have a ton of new people who've moved to town who you can definitely tell don't know what they're doing, which is completely fine. Like, you got to learn. It's not about how fast you can go. It's about how well you can stop and then maintaining momentum and don't get stuck in soft spots. Like, that's about it. But the Suburban was great. I think I joked last week about, like, it's effectively becoming like a tank, like tankish. Like, the only thing I think that will defeat it is ice. And this storm was supposed to begin with ice and transition to snow, but it was so packed when I went out. Like, I didn't really have any issues with like slipping and sliding stuff.
Nothing wins against ice anyways.
Yeah. I did watch a salt truck, like, get down through the snow just to the pavement. And I was like, is he going to go? I don't know if he's going to go. Okay. He's got it. Like, he was just trying to get down a neighborhood street. So the other thing I did was I bought some LED backup lights for the Suburban, just because it had little incandescent lights and they were nice, but I was having a hard time.
Children that like to run around in blind spots.
Constantly sometimes. So I did actually, I'm going to do the faux pas. I'm going to put my license plate out. Ooh. Now it doesn't help that like this is daylight when I took this photo. And then, oh my God, it was so dumb. So these are what the stock lights look like. Again, eventually I have to change the license plate lights now because they don't match. But
have fun with those.
Yeah, those are a little more difficult. I did not get very far installing the lights because I went to put it in. And of course it was one of those things where it's an LED light, you reverse the polarity. And then I was like, oh crap, it didn't turn on. Like, oh, I need to get it out. I'll switch the polarity. And as I'm getting out, it just came out of the socket. Yeah, the light fixture socket thing came out and went directly into the taillight housing. And I was like, oh, F. So
my fingers aren't that small.
No, they're not. And my kid had a sports meeting that I had to take him to. So like, I got the old light in. So like this rode with me across town and back, just
nice,
hanging out back there. Got back from his meeting and I was like, all right, let's actually, like, first of all, stop by O'Reilly's. Let's get a magnet because I didn't have a magnet yet. And this is, please don't judge the clutter in my garage. We're doing some remodeling as well. It had started to rain last night. So left side is the stock incandescent bulb and the right side is the LED one. Noticeably brighter. And so I did get the right one installed before I backed out for the sports meeting. And I could definitely, like, on the rear view camera, I could definitely tell the side that had the new bulb. Mm-hmm. Like, it was definitely brighter on that side. So I very happy with my purchase.
I spy a pink Barbie Jeep that needs 5 horsepower, brings a Surround engine.
It is not Barbie. It is just a Jeep. And
it's actually, just a Jeep.
Oh. It's going away soon. It does have a light up wheels that have LEDs in them. It has functioning light bar above the windshield and headlights that light up and taillights that light
up. Where is it going away to?
Anybody want to buy it? I will sell it to you. Homie, there's no way you're shipping that. And we saw you don't have a lot of room in the back of the Lexus, and I don't think you're paying for that gas.
Just drive it out here.
That's so far away.
Oh my God. Just hang on to it for like a year.
No, it takes up so much space. So I did take a little hero shot of the Suburban this morning after it got me
of the power wheels.
No, F that pink Jeep. It's gone. I do like it though. Like, it's a good, we're completely off topic with the power wheel Jeep
way
right now.
Off, way
but that one is, I want to say it's like Moderna or a company similar name to that. It's not like Prego or the other power wheels. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. I know multiple Power Wheel company names. What's up? Power Wheels like Kleenex, by the way. I just want to point that out there. Like, not all Power Wheels are Power Wheels. Anyway. But the way the electric motor on that pink Jeep goes, like, it slowly builds. It's not instant torque like we're used to. And so because it slowly builds, it's actually like great for the little one.
Small
like
children.
Yeah, the 3.5-year-old's great with it.
Oh,
so
my God. We've done how many shows now? And this is like the first time that Power Wheels has come up. That's actually kind of amazing.
Well, you couldn't see the camouflage Polaris Power Wheel set next to it, mainly because it's camouflaged. But that's the one we'll keep because that's the one that fits the 7-year-old and the 3.5-year-old. So, and the only other thing I'm doing is I'm browsing mountain bikes because my two oldest boys are into mountain biking now. They both got mountain bikes for birthday and Christmas stuff. And they're like, hey, Dad, we want to go ride. And all I have is this like street bike giant with like an inch of a tire. So part of me wants to take them out with that and just see like if I can
get hurt. Like, you'll get hurt.
Well, if I can hang with them, like I'll put a helmet on. But like, I used to mountain bike a lot more when I was younger. So like, but like even just looking at options now, it's just like, holy crap. Can I not have a hobby that isn't crazy expensive? Like what's a cheap hobby? Like, I don't think they exist.
Swimming. If you live at the beach.
Okay.
That seems expensive.
Yeah. I say, don't you have to live at the beach then? Like
that's living at the beach. Yeah. Fair point. Fair point. I retract that statement. You
know, far away at beaches from me.
No, running isn't cheap because there is a physical toll. I got nothing.
But yeah, I got nothing. Bolt.
Yeah.
Was that Todd?
He said,
nothing. I said, I got nothing. I'm just yeah. Even, you know, anything that you think of that's a hobby, there's a system designed to extract the most money possible from you, regardless of what that hobby is.
That's where my day job exists, is in marketing. Dude. So I'm trying to separate you from your dollars.
I don't know, man. 10 years ago, I was thinking about buying a new mountain bike and should have. And I was like, I could spend $500, get a great mountain bike. Now a good bike that's like affordable is $1,500 without blinking.
I will say, like, you're not off on the $500 range. Like, you need to talk to our editor at Hooniverse, Jeff. He will steer you in the right way. He sent me some awesome options. The problem was they're all in California and I would have to then ship them here. And so then that $500 bike became like a $300 or $700 bike or $800 bike. I'll probably find something closer and cheaper, but that's the end of my updates. Yep. Cause you know, you saw in that garage, I had space for another bike, right?
Hanging from the ceiling.
There are two up there already.
Nice.
So Todd.
Yes.
Where do you want to give us a quick elevator pitch introduction?
So I am the product public relations manager for Subaru. I've just actually been doing that for almost a year at this point. Working with media, talking about all of our wonderful products, past, present, and maybe a little bit future, but not very far into the future.
The things you can talk about.
Yeah. And then prior to that, I worked in product planning. Product planning for pretty much anything that we make at one point or another.
At Subaru? So, like you, yes. You moved over. Oh, okay. How long have you been with Subaru?
Since 2004.
Holy crap.
Okay. All right. So you've seen the explosion of Subaru.
Yeah, actually, you know, I was there. I got a company car. The first company car that I got was a 2003 yellow Baja.
Nice.
Oh my gosh.
That's awesome. Turbo? And manual?
Manual, non-turbo. But then the second one, and this was fun, because nobody wanted it because it didn't have a radio. It was an 04 STI. Oh, and those cars back then, the radio was optional. So
crazy.
You know, like nobody wants this. It doesn't have a radio. It's like, in, take it. Give it to me.
That's a great company car.
Yeah, it was the best company car, I think, ever.
What color was the STI?
Gold wheels. It was blue with the gold wheels. And
what was 04? Was that?
That was the first year.
First year of the, was it a Bugeye or a Hawkeye? At that point.
So it was the interim. I think they called it the blob eye is what
blob. Blob eye.
Yes.
It's the kind that I want, Ross.
Let's see. Yeah, that's like the STI. So I learned to drive manual transmission on the 2005 Legacy GT
wagon. Thank you, Doug.
So Subaru has kind of been in my blood.
Doug, of course, drove one. And so we have a picture, Doug, with Doug in a blue STI.
Is that on our 888s? Oh, my God. That it is so much tire for that car. Okay. So you've been with Subaru since 04. What made you move over? Was it just you like changed positions? Was it looking for something different, like trying to get see a different side of things, or?
Yeah, I mean, I had done the planning thing for about 9 years, so it was time to do something different. And I really love Subaru. I like working at Subaru, and over the years, I'd done a lot of different things with the PR staff, and I really like working with them. So, you know, it was kind of a natural thing for me, where it's like I, you know, a lot of experience even before the product planning with Subaru and with engineering and with, you know, the auto industry. And then I like working with those guys. It just was a good place to go. So I moved over.
Were you into cars before starting your career with Subaru?
Yeah. From like, yeah, I think my first word was probably car.
Good. That's great to hear. We're much approval there. So what's in your own personal garage at this point?
So I have a 5-speed Impreza hatchback that I drive, like the daily kind of car. And then
recent one?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a 2021. And then a 06 WRX wagon
excellent.
That we have to kind of do the practical thing faster.
Mm-hmm. Homie, that is a car I want.
They're so good.
It's so much fun.
My best friend had a Saab 9.2 X Aero, which was an 06 or 07 WRX wagon, and it had an STI swap, and it was just so rowdy. But yeah, it's the perfect size car. You know, it can do everything, and it's just not huge, enormous.
What color is your wagon?
It's WR blue.
As it should be. Okay, so you have that. And is it stock, or is it, have you like gone down the rabbit hole?
So we got it and it was stock, and we paid through the nose to find like a clean low mileage Hawkeye wagon. And then after we got it, it's like, what's that?
Did you find it in the Northeast?
So we did, actually it was up in Connecticut, but,
oh no shit.
Interesting. You know, working for the car company, we were able to kind of figure out where it had been, you know, because people have it serviced at dealers and stuff.
Yeah,
and the car was not a Connecticut car. The car had actually come from, the lower middle part of the country somewhere. And it had only just gone to Connecticut. So it was actually, it's very clean underneath. It was really nice. So we got it. And then, you know, it's like, well, should make it a little bit louder. And then so... evolved a little bit, but it's not super crazy modified.
Okay. So good.
So what else? You sound like there's more.
There's more. So as I progress down the into the stupidity, and I'll say none of these are really off-road vehicles. So
that's fine.
Okay, dude. We're all about anything automotive here.
You had WRX wagon. We're good. Like, we've checked the box.
Okay. So the next one I have a Lotus Elise.
Oh. Excellent. Okay.
And Austin Mini.
Yes. All right. So you've touched every corner.
The Mini is an 80.
That's awesome. Is it? So, what engine is in it right now? Is it
so it's a 1 liter, so it's like the middle engine. It's not the super fast one, but it's fast enough to keep up with traffic.
So which is all you need for something that weighs that much and is that size.
It's 1300 and some pounds, 1350, something like that.
Would like to let the record show that is less than a player's razor right now.
Yes, it is.
So how long have you had the Elise, and is it modified? Have you like track prepped it or tracked it?
I have had it almost 12 years at this point.
Oh, wow. Okay. Wow. So you got in when they were like technically 12 years ago, they were still sold in US in 2010.
Yeah. It was still under the warranty.
Oh, wow.
So I bought it secondhand from a guy. Oh yeah. It's, I do. It's I don't drive it very much, but it's I do enjoy driving it. It's mm-hmm. just it's you know, I take the top off in the in like March, and then it never comes out with a top on it.
Perfect. Yeah, Todd, who I write for at Everyday Driver, has one. You know, it's the pinnacle of sports car. There's nowhere really to go in terms of actual involvement from there unless you just jump to like Caterham, you know, but that's really slippery slope.
You can jump into a Caterham.
You have to jump into a Caterham. There's no other way.
Me being the Subaru guy, I will say that the BRZ is also an amazing, you know, car to drive as that type of smaller lightweight car. I mean, it is a bit heavier, but it's really stress-free.
Yes.
In right. comparison right. to something that's like a giant potato chip.
No, it's going to break.
Modern crumple zones. Yeah.
Yeah. No. But the BRZ, I've driven them a bunch and I love them to death. They're just you know, especially the new one, you yes. know, it's you know, it just does everything incredibly, incredibly well. And it's easy to live with. It's a car you can drive every day and pretty much do anything you want, you know, performance wise, except maybe go off road.
The prior gen, some people have done like 1.5-inch lifts on the prior gen, done mud flaps and like snow tires, and it's a rally car, you know? So off road is just what you make of it.
Yeah.
But Chris has spent some time. You drove the current BRZ.
Yes, I did.
It was amazing.
I got hot laps on Road America in it. So I hopped from that to like the, I was in a BRZ. I was in one of the Supras. I don't remember what, I think it was the bigger engine, and then a Lexus. And I tried to fit myself into the Miata as well to try and get a comparison. And at 6'4" with a helmet on, I literally don't fit in the Miata. So, but I fit comfortably in the BRZ.
You fit fine in the BRZ.
Yeah, that was a piece of cake. I still had a little bit of headroom. And it was the first one I drove on Road America without having ever driven Road America. And so my first lap around, I was making sure I didn't do anything I wasn't supposed to do and also bend the car for everyone else that day. But no, I think I went out like 3 or 4 times in it, and I had a blast. Like, it was, you can have both windows down because you're on a track and that's what you're supposed to do on a track. And there's not insane buffeting of the air at 100 mile an hour plus. Like the Supra, mm-hmm. once you have the windows down, like
you have to go window down on Road America.
Yes. Or at least the people that we were there with were like, put your windows down. I was like, yeah, I don't understand that. So
one less thing to crack or break open if a journalist puts it in the fence at 80 or 90.
And the group we were there with, that wasn't that big of an issue. Yeah, it was not that. Everybody I was with was an automotive journalist, at least. Like, yeah. Everyone had car experience.
Todd, can you speak to like the development cycle of this BRZ at all? Because it was probably only like 3 years ago that there was a flutter of like questions about, is the BRZ going to get another generation? You know, is this a one and done, you know, magical story of a partnership? Was there anything that, you know, stuck out to you in terms of this happening, or is there anything you can talk about on that front?
No, I mean, it was, you know, the automotive development cycle is really long. You know, I think it's a lot longer than people think of, you know, especially when you get to the part where when you first start, there's a long period of time where you're planning what you're going to do. Because when you come out with a car, you're coming out with a car, you know, a few years into the future, and you need to predict where the market's going, you know, not necessarily what you want to, you know, just make with that car, but what's the market going to be like? So, you know, you need to change it in certain ways. And so, you know, with BRZ, you know, was developed in a partnership with Toyota. And I think because of that partnership, maybe things were a little bit kind of kept close to the vest. But, you know, it wasn't a last minute thing where it was kind of like, oh gosh, 2 years ago, let's get this going. You know, it was an ongoing, it's been an ongoing project since kind of the first, you know, first car began development. Really? really long time ago. You know, and there's obviously, once you start with the current, or the new generation, there's time before you start doing the planning for the next one. But it wasn't kind of a last minute thing. I know that there were maybe some people that were surprised that we did come out with another generation of the car. But I think for us, both brands really liked the car, liked having it in the lineup, liked mm-hmm. what it did for them. And the enthusiasts that bought it really enjoyed them. They were, you know, a profitable car to make for both of the brands. And, I think in terms of both brands, we didn't go into the first generation car with the expectation that it was going to be like a Corolla or a Camry and sell enormous volume. I think, we were happy with the volume that the car did the first time around, or we wouldn't have made the second generation.
Yeah. I mean, to touch on 2 points, I do think there is some kind of aspect to the automotive media where they start bringing up questions like that to get information out of the automakers. So, you know, whereas you and Subaru and Toyota were probably talking about this in like 2015, it was hush hush, and everybody was kind of going, well, it's been out for 5 or 6 years. So is something going to happen? And by bringing out that question, it tries to prod people like you into spilling the beans.
What's the old adage? Is that I can't speculate on future products.
I can't speculate on. I'm just here so I don't get fined.
Yeah. Which is I like that you're talking about like looking ahead, because I also feel like the BRZ is great. It's a great little sports car. It definitely has its own niche. But the Wilderness lineup, for whoever saw that 2, 3, 5 years ago and was like, that's where we need to go, it's fantastic.
Yeah, actually, when I was in planning, and me and some of the guys there, we were part of the group that really were pushing for that idea, that concept, you know, because, you know, part of it is we just saw our owners, what they were doing with the cars, and they were taking them further off road, and they were telling us like, hey, you know, we like what you make, but we want more of it. We want more right. capability and more, you know, more adventure readiness kind of built into these products. And then we started kind of looking around and you know, watching what these guys were doing. And, you know, for the whole Wilderness thing for us, is what we found was our owners were a little bit different than some of the other brands, like for example, Jeep. You know, people would buy a Wrangler for the purpose of off-roading.
Right.
You know, they want to go off-road. They want to climb over boulders and rocks and things, and they'll make incredible compromises in the car that they have to be able to climb over that thing.
Yeah.
And what we found with the Subaru guys was they said, you know, they weren't into off-roading as the activity. They wanted a car that was going to get them to the activity that they wanted to do, the biking or the kayaking or the overlanding. They wanted a car them there without, you know, maybe without the complexity. They just wanted to go and they wanted those things.
It to be the means to their end, but,
you know, so there's not
break in getting there,
you know disconnectable sway bars and all that stuff, which is really super cool stuff, but you know, our buyers are, you know, the Wilderness, you know, guys, you know, when I say guys, it's in a general sense, which is kind of they want to be something that is a daily car. You drive it every day. You still have the expectation that it's going to be comfortable and safe, but hey, we really want it to do these things. So we just started trying to figure out, okay, what can we do to be better at those things without, you know, completely destroying what the baseline car is. And so you get it to, well, we get as much ground clearance as we can, you know, put some more aggressive tires, work on the approach and departure angles and the gearing. But then we started getting into the other piece where, you know, let's make the interior durable you know, so we have a water resistant fabric and all weather floor mats, and the cargo area is all, you know, everything in the interior is easy to clean. But it's nice stuff. It, you know, it's not something that, that feels, you know, cheap or plasticky. It's all got a nice feel to it, but it's all easy to clean. And then we took the crossbars, you know, on the Outback, they have kind of a folding crossbar that's really versatile.
It's just awesome. You know, the fact that you can just unclip them and swing them to the side for less wind noise and for better gas mileage.
And they're super convenient, but they couldn't hold a lot of weight, you know, so there was kind of a price for the convenience, you know, so we went back to the kind of basic ladder type crossbars for the Wilderness, and, you know, they can hold, I think it's 700 pounds, you know, statically. So you can put a roof tent up on the car, or, you know, a big basket with heavy stuff in it, you know,
spare tire and gas cans and all the
crap. You know, your dynamic load limit is lower, but it's still pretty substantial, you know, for that type of car. So we really just kind of went into the overall use case and kind of tailored the vehicle for those buyers. And they've been really well received for us, both the Outback and the Forester.
Yep.
I think we're about, in the last few months, about 20% of the sales mix is Wilderness, which is really high.
That is fantastic. You go, like, that's a huge percentage.
And so it's also a good canvas for the guys that really want to go even further. It's a great starting point, you know, even to go down that path. That you've got a lot of stuff already on the car.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I had seat time in one, and I had it on an off-road course with a 392 Wrangler. I didn't get the 4xe Wrangler, but I drove a Bronco. I did not drive the TRX. I drove a Raptor. I drove a Bronco.
Oh, different course.
No, same course, but I didn't drive it. I didn't drive the TRX. I was like, that's not going to fit. I'm not dealing with that. by the time I got to the Subaru Outback Wilderness, like, somebody else had already been a little too robust in some off-road things that they shouldn't have done. And so I didn't get to do some of the obstacles that I 100% know myself and that car could have done. And I was a little frustrated because I didn't get to say, like, it did everything that every other off-road vehicle did there, but because I didn't want to, again, continue to damage the car for other people. Somebody drove too fast through the whoops and pop some front fascia off. It wasn't, the car continued to function completely. But what I learned is that in the Wilderness, X mode stays on at higher speeds.
Yeah. No, that was the thing when we were, one of the things we did very early on in that, you know, that development is because a lot of us, we weren't really off-road guys. So we said, you know, let's take these standard cars off-road. And we got some kind of, I guess I'll call them crushers, prototype cars or whatever, that we're going to be ultimately destroyed. And we just took them off-roading where you don't have to really be terrified that you're going to permanently damage it. And we just pushed them to see, you know, how far you can go. And we were all genuinely surprised at how capable the standard models were when we really, really pushed them. But then we took back and said, well, these do the things we can improve and do better, and we did that on the Wilderness. But it was really interesting to take them, you know, as far as they'll go.
It leads to the old adage that the best off-roader is the one you care about the least,
or the one you have. And that's, I think, how some people with standard pre-Wilderness Outbacks found out that these things can actually, like, go places, for lack of a better phrase. Backing up, Todd, so when you were looking at helping or being a part of the creation of the Wilderness line, what led to that? Was there, so, like, this is going to be some inside baseball stuff, because Chris and I both work in marketing, and, like, it's, you know, a lot of the auto industry is kind of trying to prod into the brain of the people who make the stuff that we actually want to and get to drive. So did you tap into existing Outback owners, aspirational Outback owners? What was the methodology, if you can, you know, speak to how Wilderness came to be? Was it like talking to Jeep people and asking what they wanted to see in Outbacks? How'd you create this?
So, you know, it's when you're in that space, you're really looking for pretty much any piece of data that you can get from anywhere, you know, be it syndicated research studies, which if you're an OE, you can get a lot of different research studies about a lot of different things. And you can kind of cut through that and slice through that. And, you know, you can say, well, you know, here's three cars in a given segment. And you can see the owner profiles in terms of even hobbies and interests and you know, what makes you unique and what makes you not unique. You know, all that, and you're doing that. And then you're also kind of looking at the bigger trends, you know, there, you know, people are maybe going outdoors more, they're being more active, especially in the last few years. But you kind of watch the trends there and see what's happening. And then with Subaru, we are, I guess, blessed with owners who are really passionate in a broad sense, and they're really very happy to tell us what they want. So, you know, we really take a lot of pride in listening to our customers, but it's you know, it's not just the enthusiasts on the forums. You know, I think it goes back to, you know, back a long ways where, you know, we're a smaller brand, you know, our sales, you know, recently are much higher, but going back, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, the sales were much, much smaller. We don't have a dealership, you know, on every corner. So it was kind of like, if you ended up buying a Subaru, it was often because you did your research and you did a lot of research and analysis and you were looking into what kind of car, and then you found Subaru and it does these things for you and, you know, safety and reliability and all wheel drive. And you go and you end up and you find a Subaru because you researched it, not because you're like, well, I'm going to buy a car today. I'm going to stop by the place on the way home from work and pick it up.
Yeah. It's not you what's know? The biggest thing on my way home.
So, so you end up where it's not just the enthusiast, the average buyer is really highly informed with what they have and how it works. And it's really kind of surprising to me, you know, that, you know, there's that level of awareness.
Do you feel like you're working to bring to market cars for people like yourself? Has that ever kind of crossed your mind?
You know, there were a lot of, you know, different things that I worked on, and I was always, you know, in that mindset of, you know, you can't let your personal, you know, your personal opinion sway, you know, you're not making a car for you. You're making a car for, you know, a buyer and into the market. But that being said, you do want the stuff that you work on to be, you know, a thing that you like, that you would buy, right? Always try to make it that way. And when we did some of the, maybe smaller things like the special edition, like the WRXs and BRZs and stuff.
Like the ones, the color of my wall, the pumpkins.
Yeah. You know, a lot of those were you had a little freedom to say, you know what, you know, we want to make this, you know, the way that I think people like me who would buy this car would want it to be.
I mean, it's nice to have car people doing that kind of stuff, you know, versus if it was just the trope of like bean counters and A to B's, we would be in a totally different place. And, you know, I think we're seeing that in some capacity, but there's also a reason that cars like the new Toyota Subaru pairings, whether it's the BRZ or the, oh God, forgive my dyslexia. No, not that. The one that I'm totally having a dyslexic moment over, the Solterra and the whatever they're calling it, but you know, they seem exciting and they seem like they're different and not just like cookie cutter. Have you had any time or any involvement in these, in the new electric cars, the development of that and where things are going there?
So I, from a development standpoint, no, you know, that, that was an area that I didn't really get into before moving out of the planning side. That being said, you know, had a chance to drive some of them and experience them and, you know, get a feel for what they're like, but not being a part of the development.
Do you foresee that kind of mentality and platform having a wilderness future? Will there be some kind of off-roadified Solterra wilderness?
So I can't talk about that. But you know, that being said, you know, the wilderness really has done well with us. You know, we're doing good sales volume with them, but the people who are buying them are really enthusiastic about them. Like, we see a lot of people, you know, posting these things on social media and they're just, it's a very exciting car for a lot of people. And I think that, you know, that's something that we'll do more with in the future. I think we're not done with the Outback and the Forester.
Okay.
Not ready to talk about what comes next, but I think it.
No allusions to like a Crosstrek wilderness or my hopes and dreams of a BRZ wilderness.
Not yet.
My favorite story about Crosstrek is everyone's like, when is it getting a turbo? And the last Subaru rep I talked to was like, probably never, because you guys sell everyone you make already.
So yeah, seriously. It's not like it needs help.
We probably don't see a wilderness Crosstrek for a while either, because again, they're selling them all. It's a good problem to have.
If an STI Crosstrek is ever made, I will put down a deposit upon release.
They won't,
but I just want to put that out there. So where do we want to go? I mean, you know, it's, I'm sure, tricky for you to talk future product past what is really publicly available. But I have a really, really, really bright red WRX like 10 feet from me. So I have to ask about STI. What can you tell us? I know there's probably not much, but I just have to ask.
I can't. Yeah.
That's the best response.
Yeah, I just can't. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Not ready to talk about that one yet.
I had a
feeling.
Can
you tell us about time frame? How, like, when we should or can expect some kind of news?
I would probably disappear off the earth.
Todd said that the first specs were going to leak on, like, you know, I don't know, April 2nd. That's my birthday. Weird. And also, there's an episode of the Pine Barrens, the Sopranos, that happens in the Pine Barrens. It's not too far from his house. That.
Trying to get someone eliminated? What are you doing? He's a guest.
You know, I would probably get out like three words and the signal would be cut, and that would be the last you'd see of me.
Oh, that's
man, that's funny. That's funny.
Now I'm worried about who's listening.
Right. So God, I mean, there's so much future stuff that we could talk about this year.
Real fast about wilderness though. Todd, has there been any, because you guys have Outback Wilderness, Forester Wilderness out already, and I'm assuming there will be more offerings coming just because it makes so much sense kind of in the marketplace. Have you guys run into any, your current position is very, I would say, very firm with those two. Any other surge with like Mazda cutting in with the CX-50? Have you seen any, what else has been out that's off-roady themed? I think you can see where I'm going with my question.
TRD adventure.
Yeah, like,
you know, I'm just trying to think. For the last couple of years have been so, I guess, unique because of the pandemic and then everything following with supply chain and everything. You know, we've been in a situation for a while where we could sell more if we had them. You know, we just. You know, we're building as many as we can, and it's not enough. So you know, and I'm not in a space where anymore where I can, I have access to that kind of that deep data. But it, you know, I've not seen anything where a competitor has come and kind of come in and kind of etched sales away, you know, because if you go back, you know, pre-pandemic, you know, 5 years ago, if you had a car and a competitor came in and started etching away, you'd know it because your sales were declining and you would be able to see, oh gosh, they're going to some other model. But that's, you know, not something that's been happening lately. It's a completely different scenario.
All right, bro. Sorry, I got one more off topic. You guys are like one of the few companies that still make cars. Like, you have the Ascent now, and you have the Forester, but like, you still make actual cars.
There's an Impreza. Like, yeah, there's a legacy, real actual cars. While we watch Ford pull the plug on all of their actual cars.
Yeah. No, I will say I actually was on the looking at their website for something the other day. And I looked at the top and you have the little section where it's like you can click and it's like, you know, trucks and then SUVs and then performance and then, you know, commercial. They have all the little tabs for everything. And you just click on cars and it just hit Mustang.
Yeah.
It was just so strange. Like, that's really weird.
That's the world we live in today. That's why it's so great that there is a new BRZ. You know, and that you can walk into a dealer and buy a WRX or an STI or an Outback or a Legacy and not just walk into the dealership and be, you know, bludgeoned to death with, these are our 7 to 10 different crossovers, you know, which might be where the money is. But it's also interesting that we're seeing other manufacturers. I've literally heard people refer to it as like outbackifying, you know, or like making their, like Porsche's doing the Taycan Cross Turismo and people are calling it like the Taycan Outback, you know, like the stamp is there. So it's not gone anywhere.
I think one thing that's helped us is that, you know, we have the cars, but the cars that we make are kind of unique in the marketplace, you know, with the standard symmetrical all-wheel drive, and we do make cars that I guess in addition to being really safe and reliable, we, you know, have roof rack brackets and we have a lot of little different pieces where they're pretty usable, they're pretty versatile. Just the door openings are really wide, the trunk openings are really wide, and they're just really easy, kind of, I don't say easy to live with, and maybe more versatile than a lot of the other sedans, which is kind of helps them, you know, in that niche that they're in.
I'm giggling because my oldest is approaching driving years and he was like, I'm getting a Wrangler, right? And I was
FRS.
Like,
FRS.
No, he's FRS. Not getting an FRS. He's probably getting a Forester.
Cross track. There you go. Like, manual Forester. You can't look at his phone if he's shifting years.
Exactly. Like, and again, like, it's all-wheel drive, it's safe, like, it's fairly reliable.
So I do want to back up a little bit and talk about one thing. So when the BRZ launched, and to this day, I think there is still some aspect of people who look at it and go, oh, it's a BRZ. It's got symmetrical all-wheel drive. It's a Subaru. Has that subsided at all? Or do people still assume that just because it's, you know, it has the Subaru badge on it, it's an all-wheel drive car? Like, there's definitely been stories of people who walked out of the dealership and were like, wait, crap, this is rear-wheel drive, which is, you know, a good thing.
And I think early on there might have been some confusion there, but I think for a long, long, long time, most of the buyers who are buying a BRZ or an 86 aren't people who were in the showroom and say, hey, that looks cool. They know what they're buying. They know what they're getting. Hopefully. They're into that type of car and that type of experience. I haven't heard any, you know, misinformation with that regard or any stories where somebody was surprised at the, you know,
it
didn't have power on all four wheels or anything.
Was an all-wheel drive BRZ ever considered?
No, because you know, the whole premise for that project was, you know, we wanted to take the, we wanted to keep the Boxer engine and, mm-hmm. and really do, do something to really showcase all of, from a performance standpoint, you end up with more weight higher up and then up over the nose. So when you get into something like the BRZ sports car, you want all the weight close to the middle. You want it really far down. And so by adopting the rear wheel drive architecture, they were able to move the engine. I think it was like 5 inches. It was like 5 inches lower and much further back.
Oh, wow.
You know, that's just awesome. There's no, I mean, if you ever open the hood and look at the, where the engine is in a BRZ, there's no way to put axles go into the front wheels, right. You know, and if you tried to do that, you would end up with a WRX coupe. Right. You would end up with a totally different car than what it is.
Right. Which, I mean, I'm sure some people would be thrilled about, but that's not really.
Yeah. The original idea was to showcase the Boxer engine in that, you know, what else can it do, mm-hmm. you know, and you really, you have to put it there to do that.
Right. I mean, it's pretty amazing because dynamically speaking, driving dynamics perspective, the best driving car you can get short of a Porsche is a BRZ or a Miata. And what does the BRZ share in common with a Porsche? It is that the engine does what I just tried to do with my hands and can't do, you know.
It's flat.
It's a flat design and the engine, you know, the pistons are opposite of each other, and it's keeping the center of gravity low, keeping the weight low, keeping everything compact, and allows for better driving dynamics. So, you know, it really did showcase that. And I mean, there's huge fanfare for a reason. I think if I was speaking on behalf of the audience would want to know if there's a Baja replacement coming, which really pushes on the future product stuff.
You know, I guess that's, you know, that's another one. I can't really comment about the future stuff. I know we have the Baja, you know, we sold them for a few years. We didn't actually sell that many of them.
It was 04 to 07.
'03 was the first 03. Year.
Oh, wow.
And then I think 07, I think was the last year. Hmm. And, you know, so we didn't do a huge number of them, but the people who bought them love them to death. They are extremely dedicated. And, you know, the day that they went out of production, they've just been impossible to find, you know, secondhand. You know, they're really hard to find. There was one on Bring a Trailer, I guess a couple days ago. Mm-hmm. Somebody had I think it was an 04, 05. It was not a turbo. It was just a blue manual Baja with blue. Very, very low miles. And I think it closed out at like $41,000.
That's right.
Holy shit. $41,000? And it was probably what, like 25 or 26 new?
Probably in that range, yeah.
Oh my God. That's a huge number. I mean, that was like, I mean, Subaru is doing amazing things now, has done amazing things over the last, you know, decade. But if you think about the fact that in 04 to 06, there was the Baja, which you get with a turbo and a manual. There was the Forester XT, which you get with turbo and a manual. And there was the STI and the WRX wagon, all concurrent. Like, that was a special, special time in cars.
Yep. I actually, in 2005, every Subaru in the US you could get with a turbo and a manual.
Every Subaru. Yeah. Legacy. Like, again, I learned to drive stick on a Legacy GT wagon.
You could get the sedan, you could get the wagon, you could get the Outback with a turbo and a manual, the Forester. you know, the crap. WRX, the STI, and the Baja.
And I will say, I mean, CVTs in a lot of applications are like the bane of everybody's existence because they're needy and they drive like crap. But Subaru has actually done an admirable job of making CVTs not just livable, but like actually kind of good, you know, especially in the Outback. It's like a totally, totally good transmission. Nobody who doesn't know what a CVT is would ever think that it's anything different from a normal automatic gearbox. But bring back the manuals. Let's do a manual Wilderness, you know, that would be awesome.
It's hilarious. I have
to say that. I'm contractually obligated to say that.
You're getting paid?
Contractually obligated to our imaginary contract because we have no contract and we don't get paid.
my old man contract says I have to say stay with the automatic.
Well, I will at least say that I am a manual diehard. So
yeah, your garage reflects that.
Yeah, exactly.
Given that no Lotus Elise was ever sold with the manual, as far as I know, or with an automatic.
Yeah.
That was a Freudian slip. Christ. Yeah. Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
So you want to end on that?
Yeah, on that. From
you offending the internet?
Yeah. From Lotus Elise to Subaru Outback. We've been all over the place today.
Sweet. I'll wrap up the show real fast. So you can rate and review the show, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, anywhere you listen to it. We'll take a review if you got it. You can like and subscribe on YouTube. Subaru's social media is Subaru_USA on Instagram and Twitter. I didn't dig deep enough on Facebook. I'm sure they're there too. Google, if you search for Subaru on Facebook, I'm sure they're there. You can follow The Hooniverse on Twitter, The Real Hooniverse on Instagram. You can read what we write on Hooniverse, UTV Driver, ATV Rider, Everyday Driver, and U.S. News and World Report, which I just made edits on something today. So hopefully
all of the places. Soon. We got our fingers everywhere.
And Ross is at No Not Like the One for Friends, and I'm at Overlanding Dad. And we've done it. We've done the show. Thank you, Todd.
Thanks, Todd.
Thank you very much.